Well, thank you everyone for coming to what I think probably is the session that has the, at least on the running, for the worst title possible for a tech ed session. And especially after the keynote, well, it was not the keynote, the IT Pro introduction kickoff session last week, if I had my way, I'd have changed the name and we'd be talking unicorns and fire-breathing dragons with Server 2012. Because as we said, the file server system now with Server 2012 is so vastly different to what it was previously that it really is something completely different. And so my name's Jerome Brown. I'm a technical specialist with Oliker. And at Oliker, we're a specialist systems integrator. We're gold partners in desktop and management and virtualization. We are experts in infrastructure management and virtualization, specializing in the design and deployment of Microsoft and Citrix technologies. And our focus is in two areas, private cloud and Windows client. And it's from both of these areas that I'm coming from as we're looking at SMB3. So the key things I want to look at is to think through, why is it that you're here today? What is it that you've heard so far about SMB3 that's encouraged you to come to this session with such a horrible title? Now, as a quick show of hands, who here is running a SAN in their organisation? And of those running a SAN, how many of you would say it's probably the biggest single investment that you have in your IT infrastructure? See, SANs take up a lot of money. And Microsoft's research says that about 40% of IT hardware budgets are spent on storage. And so it's with this in mind that Microsoft has really tried to change things with Server 2012 to make things different. And so what I wanted to do is just have a wee reflection on what a SAN is. So who can relate with one or all of those ideas and promises as to what a SAN should be? But in the end, all the SAN does is it stores our files, it stores our data, and makes it accessible across multiple platforms. And so if the vendor's selling SAN as this magical unicorn that's going to do absolutely everything for us, well, what's SMB been? It's kind of been relegated to the poor cousin, hasn't it? And this is why we've not run our applications with SMB storage as the back end, because the performance hasn't been there. And this is something that Microsoft is aware of. In the 12 plus months that they were going out and talking to customers and finding out what they wanted, one thing that kept being reiterated is this ability to do enterprise storage on industry standard hardware. You see, this is what virtualization's given us, is this ability to take this commodity hardware, to leverage it together, and provide something new with it. And so now we're gaining the economies of scale from a virtualization side of things. Why can't we be doing the same thing for storage? And so with the design of Server 2012, there was a key driver for the storage aspect as to what Microsoft were looking to achieve. And that is they wanted parity with key values of best-in-class SAN storage. And that's a pretty lofty goal to be aiming at. And as we go through the slides today in this session, I'll show you what Microsoft have done to try and achieve this goal. So it starts out by improving the availability and reliability of SMB storage. Because that's one thing that we know that SANs have, is availability and reliability. But it needs to be done with a competitive performance level. We can't have our servers running at 30, 40, 50, 60% CPU just to process the I/O in order to move away from a SAN. And we need the ability to make sure our applications can continue to be backed up for the event of a failure. But why is it that as organizations we're interested in moving to SMB storage for our applications? The key driver is cost. Not just in the acquisition cost of the SAN itself, but in the ongoing maintenance and management of that SAN. And we then get the advantages that we have as Windows admins of being able to leverage our knowledge and our skill base across a wider group of admins in order to do the management of it. So performance is key. So we look here, the gold standard that we have at the moment really is direct attached storage. And so this set of benchmarks was done a number of months ago on the Server 8 beta code. So it's quite an old set of benchmarks, but it sets the standard for what we're talking about today. And so with 22 10K SAS disks, they were able to achieve 4,300 transactions per second with SQL. That's the standard we're looking at. You can pretty quickly see why we never ran SQL across SMB2, can't you? 28% of the IOPS. But look at that. SMB3 across gigabit Ethernet to the same storage that we tested here for the 4 gig fiber channel, 99% of the transactions. See, here today, what I'm going to try and do is to challenge your thinking about SMB and move your thinking of it just as a way of storing our company files to think of SMB as something that we can use to also store our application data. And so I've got a bit of swag to give away here. So we've got SMB. Let's have a quick test. Who wants to give us a shot at when SMB was first introduced? What year? Close, but not quite. 86, we're getting very close. Here, T-shirt for you, sir. 1984 is the first description of SMB. That's right. So it's from an IBM technical paper around the time of the introduction of OS2. And then in 1996, Microsoft looked to, as they're competing with Sun, rename SMB to SIFS. So that's why we get the two names for it, to compete with the Web NFS. Okay, for another T-shirt, so the Server 2012 T-shirts, what was the next major update to the SMB protocol? Before SMB2. Something we rely on today. Over TCP/IP. Well done, here you go, have a T-shirt. And so this moved it away from being reliant upon net BIOS as we were used to. So, okay, 1984 for reference, 1992 was the most common application with Windows for workgroups of it, and then TCP/IP. Now, who was it that said SMB2? T-shirt for you, sir. They don't fly very well. So SMB2 came out with Windows Vista. So realistically, apart from changing the protocol over which SMB ran, there was very little update in the protocol for 20 years. So you can see why it had a ways to go. SMB2 introduced better performance with larger reads, but it still wasn't enough to get us where we needed to go. SMB 2.1 with Windows 7. So again, we've got file leasing improvements here, larger transmission units, again giving us some performance, and the introduction of branch cache. But still, it's not enough. All of this really has been focused on delivering files to our users on their desktops. And this is why we haven't been able to use SMB for our applications. First of all, we've been bound by CPU. Because we're running over TCP/IP, we've got to process every packet as it comes through. And especially in high I/O scenarios with lots of small I/Os, it's very easy for us to bottleneck the CPU processing that network data. We also have network bandwidth. Who here is running anything faster than gigabit Ethernet? So we have a few, but not many. The majority of us today are still running on gigabit Ethernet. And so when we compare that to, say, 4 gigabit on the fiber channel, you can see why there's the hesitance as well to be running across Ethernet rather than fiber channel for our storage. Now, I'm aware that some of this is alleviated by being able to team NICs, and in the architecting private cloud, we had a number of people who are running 10-plus NICs in their servers, able to team them together in order to gain the performance. But remember, this has officially been unsupported by Microsoft until teaming's been introduced in Server 2012. The other issue, again, being TCP-based, we wait for TCP timeouts if we've got an issue with our file server. So that takes two rounds of 20 seconds each before we fail over to another server. And then when we do fail over, we're going from an active server to a passive server. So we have to reconnect all our file handles, initiate all our connections again. Now this works okay for a user sitting at their desktop with a Word document, because if they get an error message when they go to save their document because the cluster's failed over, they just hit retry and it saves it for them. But we don't have anyone sitting there on a SQL server to hit OK to reconnect the MDF file if it's running across SMB storage. So what's Microsoft done to address these issues? The first key point that I want to talk about here is SMB Direct. Now, the reason I want to start with this is because this is a technology that you probably don't have in your data centers at present, and it's probably not something you're going to rush out to retrofit into your data centers. However, as you're looking to expand and progress, it's worth knowing because this is where we get our best performance from it. So what we're looking at is high-speed, low-latency networking utilizing RDMA. So the DMA portion we're all familiar with at the moment. So that's the drivers will load, for example, blocks off the disk, and rather than the CPU then having to process them and make them available, we read it straight into our memory. Well, what RDMA does is exactly that, but across the network. So the way it works, we start from our server requesting data from the file server. The two NICs talk and identify that they have RDMA capability. The file server reads it from disk, passes it to the RNIC in the server, and it's loaded straight into memory for the applications. We bypass the CPU completely. So not only do we get past the bottleneck of CPU processing of TCP packets, but we also don't have to process the data when it arrives as well. And the way I like to think about it is as a cheaper alternative to fiber channel. Now, it's not the best analogy, because we're still talking a protocol that's different from fiber channel. But the concept that we have at the moment where we need dedicated fiber channel switches along with dedicated interconnects applies to certain variations of RDMA, most notably into InfiniBand. And we'll talk about that as we come to it. But it's not something like just expanding your existing network. This is what I want to get across there. It bypasses the CPU, but it will run at 56 gigabit a second. To give you an idea, if your storage can handle that, you can transfer a DVD per second per RDMA card. So dwell on that, gigabytes a second transferred directly into memory. I think that's probably fast enough performance for us. And the best thing is it's transparent to the application. It just requests the file from the file share, and it's up to the RNICs in Server 2012 to do the heavy lifting for us. Now, we do need to be aware that RDMA has come from high-performance computing, so has a lot of potential, but it is only used for SMB traffic in Server 2012. Now, it's not actually as big a limitation as it might seem, because within, for example, the clusters now, any redirected cluster traffic in Server 2012 is now run over SMB. So realistically, it's only IIS workloads, management traffic and the like that we're not having run over SMB. So it's applicable in a lot of scenarios. So say it does need dedicated RNICs, RDMA NICs, and there are the three main protocols. So InfiniBand needs its own dedicated switches, its own dedicated cards and cabling. But it's available today at 56 gigabit a second, and it's cheap. iWarp will run across Ethernet. You do need specialized 10 gig Ethernet switches to do it, and you can't route them around. So there are some limitations to it, but Rocky there, RDMA over converged Ethernet, it's fully switchable, fully routable. But you don't want to be running it over anything less than 10 gig Ethernet. These prices were taken from America from Hewlett Packard as an idea of how much it's actually going to cost you to go to RDMA. So we're all familiar, we've got our 1 gig Ethernet. We're around at about 23 cents a megabyte to shift data around. We look at 8 gig fiber channel, $2.51, and 56 gigabit InfiniBand at 18 cents a megabyte. So yes, it's an extra layer of complexity, it's an extra set of switches to manage, but it's significantly cheaper than even going to 10 gig Ethernet, and the performance that we get is significantly better. So what do we use now until we can move to RDMA? This is where SMB multi-channel comes in. What we basically are looking to do is create multiple connections per SMB session. Simplest way to think about it is if you've got a road that's bottlenecked, what's the simplest way to get more cars down the road? Widen it, add more lanes. And that's all that multi-channel does. It looks and it negotiates with either end of the SMB connection And if it can create extra lanes, it will do so. So the upshot of this is you can gain full throughput of all the interfaces in your server. Now, yes, you can get this with teaming, and multi-channel will work with teaming, but multi-channel will also work independent of teaming as well. The other technology coming through now with a lot of the server NICs is what's called receive-side scaling. So I talked earlier that one of our issues with SMB traffic is that we can peg a CPU trying to process our data as we're reading it in. And the reason for that is naturally any interrupt that comes through on the network card, any new connection, any traffic coming in, goes to the first core in your system. And that's fine for big IOs because you're reading a lot of data, you're not processing lots of small ones. But if you've got lots of small TCP packets, you can very easily peg that CPU core and have another three or seven cores sitting there basically idle. So what RSS allows us to do is to split that processing across all the cores in the server. Multi-channel also gives us a level of failover. Because we're creating multiple channels, if one channel goes down, the others continue along uninterrupted. And it's end-to-end detection. So we're still on the TCP timeouts, and this is where teaming works very well with multi-channel. Because if you create a team and then run multi-channel over it, you'll get the benefits of identifying the failover quickly, because the team will do that, and you get the multiple channels that you get with multi-channel. And it's automatic configuration. Multi-channel is turned on by default in server 2012, and I highly recommend that you do not disable it. If you disable multi-channel, you will lose functionality, for example, like the ability to use RDMA NICs as well. Because it's the multi-channel protocol that does the negotiation between client and server and SMB to identify the capabilities of both ends and to decide what technologies can be used. Can we use RDMA? Can we use receive-side scaling? How many interfaces do I have and how many connections can I create between those interfaces? And I'll show you this automatic configuration in a demo in a moment. So how does this look? So this is probably quite a common scenario for us today. A client and a server both with 2 1-gig NICs. Transfer starts from, the client requests data from the server. The negotiation happens. We identify that we have an interface each on each end. And we create a second channel to take advantage of the second interface. Things get a little bit more fun when we introduce, say, a 10-gig NIC with receive-side scaling. In this scenario, after that initial negotiation to identify both sides support receive-side scaling, we'll create up to 4 channels across that interface. Now, this is configurable. You can add or remove channels as you wish. It's a simple PowerShell command. Of course, everything's PowerShell today, to change that number. 4 was chosen because 3 was too few, 5 was too many. We'll start with 4. Comes down also, I think, to the number of cores that are usually in servers as well. When we add teaming to the mix, we will automatically assume receive-side scaling. So if we're presented with a NIC team, we will create 4 channels. So this is where you might want to adjust the number of channels that are created by default if you know that you've got a good-sized team and that can handle more than 4 channels. And create, and say, in this scenario with 10 gig Ethernet, say, to do over 8 channels. Now, the key piece with this is that for the teaming to work and multi-channel to take full advantage of this, you do need to have your switch support for teaming as well. The reason for this is by default, a switch will only respond on one MAC address per IP address. So the team, obviously, multiple interfaces, multiple MACs with one IP. The switch doesn't understand that I can send to multiple MAC addresses to that one IP. You'll be pegged onto whichever MAC address the switch has decided is the one to send it through. So as long as you have your, I forget the acronym, LACP, that's the one, thank you very much. As long as you have your switch with LACP support, you can take full advantage of the multiple NICs and teamed. And then RDMA. So again, we start the connection over a TCP 10 gig Ethernet connection, identify both sides are capable of doing RDMA and the speed that they can do it at, and then we'll fire up multiple channels that are dependent upon the support of the card. The TCP connection is kept around in this scenario in case of failover, but everything else is moved across to the RDMA. One of the key pieces to remember is you cannot team RDMA NICs. So the reason for this being that they're trying to write directly into memory, if we put another abstraction layer over the top of the RNIC, then we can't write directly into memory, so we lose that capability. So if you want the failover capability with RDMA, you need to be using SMB multi-channel. So how would we use this really? This is a very basic design of what we're looking at for a customer of ours. So we have here our Hyper-V server, two or more NICs depending on the exact requirements for the workload, teamed together. Now this can be either with LACP or without, better if it's with, and then we use the multi-channel across that to make sure we get the full use of the bandwidth from that. The key reason why we're obviously wanting to team that set of NICs there is because we can only present a single NIC to a single extensible switch in Hyper-V. For our storage and management, and this comes into the converged way of looking at things, as was talked about in the private cloud architecture one, we just allow multi-channel to do its thing there. Again, if we have LACP, we probably want to enable teaming to take advantage of the faster failover. But if we don't, we just give multiple IP addresses and let multi-channel work that out. On the other side with our file server, again, we probably want more NICs over in the file server because we're not going to have a one-to-one relationship between Hyper-V hosts and file servers. And we want to make sure that we don't have a bottleneck there on our network interface. So again, if we can team them, we team them. If not, we use the four disparate NICs. So jump in and show you a quick demo of how SMB multi-channel works and how it automatically detects. So what I have here is two servers back in our scenario. Our file server there has four NICs. The machine I'm going to use, I'm only going to use two of them because I've got an issue with the third NIC. So all I do is I'm copying my nice large VHD. It could be any file. And you see very quickly we're pegging out here at 110 megabytes a second. So that's the practical limit of gigabit Ethernet for a single connection. While we're here, I'll show you some of the performance counters that we now have with SMB in Server 2012. Notice how they look exactly the same to the performance counters that you can gain if you're accessing local disk. So we have average requests per second, the number of bytes that are being requested per second, and so on. So if I come and enable a second interface, what we'll see, it takes a moment or two for Windows to register it's been enabled, for it to pick up its IP address and connect into the network. Once that happens, SMB multi-channel identifies that, hey, I have a new interface presented to me, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to recalculate and see what I can now do. Does that change the way that I do things? And I think we've got a little bit of load on our network. It's pulled up to 150 megabytes a second. If we give it a moment or two, here we go. We'll pull that up, and that will pull through to around 200 megabytes a second. So what we're doing here, we're now utilizing 2 1-gig Ethernet connections, pretty much for the full use of them, simply by enabling that. To simulate a failure in the copy, if I now go and disable that interface again, multi-channel works with that. We just see our copy drop back to the 110 megabytes a second. Again, the single interface speed that we have there. So it's all transparent to the applications. It handles it all for ourselves, and we can gain this additional performance benefit. It's one thing to have performance, but we need to make sure that it's always going to be available. This is where SMB transparent failover comes into play. So if we were able to, and this is a hypothetical scenario here, if we were able to, say, run Hyper-V from Server 2008 R2 across SMB, this is what would happen. We have ourselves a Server 2008 file server cluster. We're active on our node. For some reason, the node goes down. We fail over to the second node. All seems well, except for the fact that we've lost all our connections and our file handles. So an administrator needs to log into that machine and reconnect those file handles up so that we can continue processing. So not only have we waited 40 seconds to flip over, we're now actually waiting for somebody to wake up at 3 a.m., log in remotely, and reconnect the SQL database, or the Hyper-V VHD. Compare this to Server 2012 with transparent failover. So same scenario, we're running our SQL or our Hyper-V workload with our application data stored on the file server. The file server goes down for some unknown reason. The connection and the handles are now auto-recovered on the second node in the cluster. And because we're able to fail over faster with transparent failover, all the application has seen is a delay in the I.O. So it's read or it's write, in the vicinity of 4 or 5 seconds. Now, to put this in perspective, SQL can handle, I think, up to 15 seconds of I.O. delay before it starts to get cranky. But everything continues on with no errors. So to support this, there are some new components added into the SMB3 protocol. So I'll talk specifically about Server 2012 because we're here, this is a Microsoft conference, and I can guarantee that that's going to work. But technically, this can be also implemented by other vendors, say, into NAS boxes, if they're going to support SMB3. So all of these features, the multi-channel, RDMA, transparent failover, could be supported by a vendor on a NAS for you. So within the client, first of all, what we do is we keep a history of the transactions that we're doing, the file writes that we're doing, not only for read, but write and delete operations as well, so that in the event of a failure, we have the ability to replay those there. On the server, we also store within our clustered shared volume information around the state that we're looking at. So we know what files are open on which application server. And this is critical in that failure in order to be able to reconnect so that we know what had what open. One of the key differences for the transparent failover is that every single file on a transparent failover cluster will be opened in write-through mode. So what this means is that the application will not accept a write until it has been committed to disk so that you never lose anything sitting in the cache. So now you think, well, isn't there a performance impact that comes with that? Yes, there is. But the workloads that we're looking at here, SQL and Hyper-V, already open their files in write-through mode anyway. And so there's no additional performance hit on that. So the resume key is what takes over in the event of a failure. It's able to read the state data that's stored in the clustered volume and reconnect the file handles to the application servers as requested. But the key piece out of all of this is our witness service. So the witness service has been added in specifically to provide faster failover in the event of a node going down. So remember with SMB2, we're reliant on TCP timeouts for the application to know that the server has disappeared. But we have a cluster that has a heartbeat. And so cluster nodes know very quickly when other nodes go down. So the way we utilize that is when an SMB3 client talks to an SMB3 scale-out server, after creating the initial connection and opening the files, it then asks for a list of all the other nodes in the cluster, picks one of those nodes, and then sends a request to that node to say, I want you to be my witness. I want you to tell me if my node goes down. And so if our first node goes down, the witness service on our second node will inform the application server that the node has gone down, instruct it to connect to itself for data, pick up where it left off. Once that's reconnected, the client will then go, I need a new witness server, and will request, again, a list of the known active nodes in the cluster and reconnect its witness service to another node. If you are running a two-node cluster, it won't be able to because obviously the other node is down, but it will continue to retry every minute until the other node comes back up. And this brings us into our scale-out file servers. They've been designed specifically for application storage. So the key limitation we have in 2008 R2 with our file server clusters is that they're active-passive. So only one node can be active at a time. With scale-out, every single node is active on that same namespace throughout the whole cluster. It's active all the way through. So this gives other advantages of the fact that we now have a unified namespace. No longer do we have to take guesses about which shares are going to have the most transactions and the most requirements, and therefore carve them up amongst our nodes, and then when things aren't right, try and rebalance it out and all of that. We create a single file structure, single set of shares, single namespace to share out. I'm sure you've also heard that CheckDisk has been improved in Server 2012 so that no longer are we offline for hours or in order to do a repair, but down to seconds. Well, within a scale-out cluster, we can now repair the file system without taking the system offline. The way this is done is along the lines of the failover, that we buffer the I.O. temporarily when the check disk needs to run, so the volume is never dismounted, never taken offline to the application. And of course, because we're adding nodes that are all active, we're increasing the bandwidth and the throughput that we can get from our file server cluster, as long as our storage can handle that. The other advantage that this now gives us is we get flexibility in choosing the way that we create our storage. So our clustered shared volume on here could either be a SAN, as we're currently using today, or you could use a JBOD SAS array and remove all the complication of a SAN. Couple this in with storage spaces or PCI RAID cards, and you have a system that will give you the performance for a fraction of the cost. Now, I mentioned that this is designed for application storage only. It is not designed for storing your users' directories, group drives on. Simple reason for that is a limitation around the clustering. The reason why previously they've been active-passive is any metadata transaction, so understanding who's opened it, who's got the file open, when it's been modified, creation and deletion of files, needs to go through the owner node in the cluster. The same still applies in a scale-out cluster, so you're going to find you're not going to gain the extra performance in a heavily file-based workload where you're creating, deleting, and opening new files all the time. If you're just opening small numbers of big files and continuously writing and reading within that file, perfect workload for it. And that's what we see with SQL, and that's what we see with Hyper-V. So again, in practice, how would we put this into play? Hyper-V cluster, connected to our scale-out file server cluster, either via Ethernet, or if we want the performance, through RDMA. We then look to add on our JBOD arrays connected either via clustered PCI RAID SAS extenders, or we could just do it through storage spaces. Yes, there is a performance hit if we just do it through storage spaces, but it becomes that trade-off in terms of what's the performance hit versus how much am I going to save by going down that route, and is it an acceptable performance trade-off for us to make? So how do we round it all up, and how do we actually manage it and use it? Because again, it's one thing to have the performance, it's one thing to have the availability, but one of the other key pieces that we needed to address was backup. How do we ensure that we can back up the data on a file server? Because this is one of the key areas that we have, making sure we have application consistent backups. This is why volume shadow copies came in, and why providers can be written for it, so that we can run a backup workload without knowing about the application and get it in an application-consistent format. But if we're now separating the processing and the data storage onto two completely different servers, how do we address this? We extend volume shadow copy to work across SMB3 file shares. So it's the same workflow that we're using currently for volume shadow copies on a local server. The only difference is that if the file is stored on an SMB share, we hand the request off to create the shadow copy to the SMB3 file server. It creates the copy and then hands back a UNC path as the location of that copy. So that does mean that your backup application will need to be updated to support receiving a UNC path as a volume shadow service. From what I'm aware, that's the only change that's required, and that capability is provided in DPM Service Pack 2012 Service Pack 1. Who here has security people working in their organization who would be nervous at the thought of SQL data running backwards and forwards across the network? I certainly know I've come from organizations where the security guys would have a conniption if you said that we want to store our database separate from our database server and run it unencrypted across the network. This is where the SMB encryption comes in, but not just for application. I think another area that we can look to use this in as IT pros is company-sensitive data. The executive share, for example, executive home drives. We probably don't want that data really going unencrypted across the network. We store it encrypted on one end. We probably store it encrypted on the client end as well. So why are we happy for it to be unencrypted between the two? The great thing is we can configure this either on a per-share basis or for a server, so any shares created across the server. And it's uses standard AES encryption, which means the chips, the CPUs that are coming out today, most of them now have a coprocessor which will handle the encryption and decryption on the fly. So again, we're not taking a CPU hit to do it. And we also know that it's guaranteed to be secure because any down-level clients will get an access denied message if they try and access an encrypted share, even if the user does have permissions to the share. So potentially that's a bit of a blocker because it's going to mean, say, on the desktop, upgrading to Windows 8. I think there's other reasons to go there anyway. But from an application side of things, we're already running Server 2012 to get the rest of these benefits. To gain that benefit of encryption is not a big deal. Has anyone actually implemented branch cache in their organization yet? A few hands going up. I know that I was certainly excited where I, the organization I was at when Windows 7 came out about branch cache because we had a lot of small sites down the end of very thin straws. And so the ability for us to cache that data of commonly accessed shares, you start running that question, well, do we host it locally for them and therefore have no backups and have no control over the data? Or do we try and centrally host that, but then they've got the performance hit? Well, that's where branch cache came in. The fundamental change in branch cache v2 is that we now, rather than having a fixed size chunk in branch cache like we did with Win7, we now have a variable size chunk. The advantage of this is it's more likely that we're going to find duplicate data by going to a variable chunk. If we have fixed chunks and we can't vary those, then what's likely to happen is the common set of data sits across the boundaries of the chunks. And so we still end up transferring most of it. Usefully, the same chunks are used for data deduplication in Server 2012. So if you enable deduplication on the volume, you've already calculated your branch cache chunks. Direct releasing just simply prevents an extra request having to be made when you want to look at a directory. So what the SMB client will do is ask the server to notify it if there are any metadata changes. So if a file name changes, new ones are added or deleted, and it can update that in the background. So again, we're speeding up the perception, at least, of the network because a user goes to browse that file share, and because we already have the metadata cached, we're not having to have that long round trip to bring that back in. Again, this only really works for read-only drives or personal home drives. Doesn't work too well with group drives where people are modifying them frequently because you end up transmitting a lot more metadata than you'd end up caching in the end. I'm sure one of the blockers for implementing branch cache has been the group policy side of things. If you want to implement hosted cache on a number of sites, you've got to create a group policy per site to configure the cache server. Well, with V2, we now auto-detect our cache servers. So you can have a single group policy which says use distributed cache if there's no server, but try and find a server to use if you can. We can now also preload those cache servers that we send out to site so that we're not having to pull the first set of data across the WAN. And for scale, we can host multiple servers per site. As with everything to do with Windows Server, it's all controllable by PowerShell. So as we've heard, if you don't know PowerShell, you probably better start learning it. If you're not going to start learning it, it might be worth looking for another career to start moving into. So this is nice and all good in theory. Well, how do we actually put this into practice? How is this actually going to change our jobs as IT administrators? The key piece is that we now have, with SMB3, much more flexible storage options. So traditionally, we've had two options that we can look at. The first is we have a single server with some direct storage. And yes, there are some technologies to try and duplicate that storage to other servers to try and give a bit of redundancy, but practically it's a single server with its own storage that sits on its own little island. The other option is to go up to an external storage array, be that a SAN or be that a NAS. And a lot of organizations have been forced into this, even though most of the additional capability of the SAN is not something that they really need or even use. And so they're forced to spend a lot of money to put a SAN in place so that they can have access to that shared data. What we now have with SMB3 is something to sit in the middle. And we can do it through a couple of ways. The first is by providing clustered access to these bunches of disks. So we put a couple of servers in, some shared storage, either be that directly attached is the easiest way through either SAS switches or just SAS replicators. And then we could either use storage spaces to carve that up, or we can use PCI RAID cards, which are cluster aware and can communicate on this. Or we can look at this new technology, and I'm actually quite excited by this. It's something that Microsoft have been hammering over at the TechEd sessions, and unfortunately no one here has actually got one, is the cluster in a box. Basically a 3U, 4U unit depending on your vendor, two or more compute nodes, little blades in there, and a bunch of storage. Pre-configured with Server 2012 in a cluster. You order it, turns up, plug it into the network, and once you've racked it, turn it on, and away you go. We have a customer who, every time they want to add a new hypervisor to their cluster, has to call in another contractor to come and do that for them because they've got no experience in-house with dealing with SANs. They don't know fiber channel networking. They don't know about LUNs and so on. And so it's adding for them $3,000 or $4,000 per server in order to connect up to their fiber channel. Scenario like this, where they can add it in, add a new node in, point it to a file server for their storage, allows them to scale out and to do it at a much more effective cost. So we've been talking about running SQL and about running Hyper-V across SMB. Now, for SQL, do need to be aware that if you want to run your main databases, you need to be on at least SQL 2008 R2. Obviously running atop Windows Server 2012. If you also want your system databases, so master and tempdb running across SMB, you need to be running SQL 2012. It's the only ones that are supported for that. And Hyper-V, it's only supported with Hyper-V 3 and Server 2012. This, I think, is the real kicker as to what we can do with SMB3. This, if you take one thing away from today, let it be this slide. This is going to fundamentally shift the way we architect data centers going forward. Because no longer do we need to have our mapping directly into our storage, we start abstracting our storage out from our application workloads. This is what we've been doing in virtualization, abstracting our servers out from the underlying physical hardware. We're now doing that for storage. Who here knows how to configure LUNs? Quite a few, so I've obviously got a lot of storage guys here, so I'm running the risk of being stoned or chased out, especially by the time we get to the end of this slide. But how many people here know how to manage shares on a Windows box? Yeah. And so what we're moving to is we're managing Windows shares, not managing LUNs on our server, on our storage arrays. We're managing standard Windows ACLs, complete with Active Directory groups, rather than having to worry about LUN masking and LUN zoning for security purposes. We can upgrade our applications and our storage independently. How many projects sit waiting for storage to come and work out, this is what we're going to need to do, this is what needs to be changed from a storage side of things in order to add another host, to change our front-end host to replace the server that's there? Conversely, how much storage, when we're upgrading our storage or introducing a new SAN or similar, do we then have to go to the business and start negotiating outages in order to move their data from one SAN to another and reconfigure the hosts and all of this? Upgrade them independently. Because if you have a file system abstraction layer in the middle, you're just simply managing shares. You upgrade the back-end storage. You go from a JBOD array to a SAN because you need the extra functionality. That's fine, move the data across, change where the share points to. You might need a small outage for the file server just to get the final copy, for the application server just to get the final copy across. But you point it back, there's no actual reconfiguration of the application that is required. Other way around, upgrading the front-end servers. You're going from SQL 08 to SQL 2012. Upgrade the SQL server, point it back to the same share that it was currently using, and away it goes. There's no need to reconfigure the storage to support the application. Key thing of Server 2012 in the Cloud OS, automation, PowerShell. Of those of you who configure LUNs, who would be happy running a PowerShell command to create new LUNs and set up masking and zoning? But if it were the PowerShell front end to do the same? Not many. Why? Question, if it was a Microsoft SAN, would you be more comfortable to do it? What changes between the vendor? Why is the SAN going to be a sticking point in our automation for the cloud? What is it that the SAN vendors aren't doing right that makes us hesitant to go and automate that? And who would be happy to run a PowerShell command to create a new share, set some permissions on it? A lot more people. You see, it's something that we're familiar with because we're doing it all the time. And it's an abstraction out. And it makes scaling out easier because we add some nodes to our file server, especially if you overlay, say, DFS on top of the file server so that you're abstracting out even the name of the file server cluster. All you have to do is just scale out either more clusters, scale out another node in the cluster, extra storage, move things around. Using storage spaces, thin provisioning, all of this allows us to scale out our storage so much easier and so much quicker. So as we're looking at this, really, is this SMB? Or is this maybe our SANs to some extent now? We've been sold it as being the unicorn that does absolutely everything, but it holds us back in so many areas. And if we look to abstract that out to say, well, let's start with a file server front end to it, but then to reconsider whether we actually need that SAN in the back, I think it's going to change the way we look at data centers. So I'm sure many of you here are technical people, especially with the number of you that understand how to create LUNs and so forth. So you've got to take something back to the boss to say, so what about this SMB3? Well, simply it's faster. It's more available. It's resilient, secure, it's cost-effective, and it's manageable. And it supports Hyper-V workloads, SQL, your documents, or your custom application. See, this is where I think we're going, that SMB and the file servers, I'm not quite convinced about the fire-breathing dragons. Fire-breathing dragons have a reputation for destroying things. But unicorns and pixie dust, now we all like those, don't we? Any questions? Yep. Yes? No. So the question is, the improvement on the first slide with the SQL transactions, was that with the use of RDMA? No, both of those were over gigabit Ethernet. There was actually a fundamental flaw that in the build of Windows Server 2012, they found in the SMB protocol that was actually hampering performance significantly. So I think a large portion of that change came from a single change in the single main change in the code base. So. Yep. From what I understand, Exchange only supports raw disk. So I think that's an Exchange requirement, not a limitation within SMB3. And it's because of the way... I'm not an Exchange guy, so check this detail out. But from what I understand, you need to present raw disk, because you don't even present it with a formatted partition, do you? Okay, so that's probably coming. I talked to the Exchange guys about support on it, but I'm at this stage... I don't know. So that's a question for an Exchange guy, I would say. Yep?
We have a use case of centralized file shares in data center and remote users, say, 4,000 k's away.
Yep.
Does SMB3 help?
Yes. I would say branch cache is probably the key portion of that. So the improvements that we see within branch cache will help in those scenarios. What size pipes are we talking about between your remote sites? So you'll probably find that, yes, the branch cache side of things will help, because what you're now doing is caching the information locally at those sites, and the ability to preload your cache servers that you send out will help from there. And I can understand that. This is a technology from the side of things that is new, and there is going to be a lot of hesitation around that, and I do understand that. Yeah. So again, to go to say gigabit Ethernet, different story. If you had 10 gig Ethernet or to look into the RDMA, that's certainly, and that's why I think a lot of this is a prompter for thinking about where do we go as well, not just what can we do today. Because on the other side of that, I don't think many organizations are just going to go out carte blanche and upgrade everything from 08 or 08R2 to server 2012. I don't think there are any organizations that just go out, new server OS, yes, this weekend we're upgrading everything. Be kind of nice sometimes. And so it's not until we start seeing organizations deploying server 2012 that we're going to see SMB3 really coming in. But for scenarios where you're starting to look at, well, okay, we're going to start replacing some things. Maybe we're running Hyper-V currently and we see the benefit of going to server 2012 Hyper-V. Let's look at how we actually architect that as we move into server 2012. Yep. That's a file system. So that's NTFS itself that does the quota. So still applies the same as it. Or as it always has. SMB3 is just the transport protocol between the two servers. So it doesn't affect how the file system works currently. Yep? Yes? Windows 8. Yep. Won't be backported because you're pretty much backporting Windows 8 to Windows 7 to do it. Oh, yeah. So server 2012, because, again, coming from when we're looking at SQL and we're looking at Hyper-V as being the main workloads that are going to benefit from SMB3, it's predominantly going to be a server OS that's going to take advantage of this. But yes, Windows 8 will take advantage of this as well. Yep?
Does server 2012 change the MTU at all?
I'm assuming that is still within the driver and the current process through, as you have it through 2008 R2 in terms of supporting jumbo frames. So I'm not familiar with the intricate details around that. So as far as I'm aware, you're still able to do it, but it's the same sort of process that you've got in 08 R2. Yep.
Yeah, one quick throwaway line about SMB3 not being suitable for group drives. And
yes. No, okay. Let me clarify. SMB3 is great for group drives. Transparent failover is not. So the cluster side of things isn't so much. So my mistake for there. So SMB3 in and of itself, yes, that will work wonderfully for group drives. It's the scale-out file servers that aren't designed for group drive use. Because there's the metadata updates, so you're creating files, you're removing files and so on a much more regular basis than you are, say, with an application workload. Because all of those metadata transactions need to be routed through the owner node in the cluster of the volume, you're going to end up with that node potentially becoming a bottleneck within the cluster. So your benefits of the scale-out nature of the cluster are diminished because you still have one node that really is the bottleneck of that. And so the traditional active-passive is still available in server 2012, so the traditional file server. So when you create a file server cluster, when you go to add a role to that cluster, it'll ask you when you're creating the file server role, do you want a traditional file server or do you want a new scale-out file server? And so for your group drives and your home drives and so forth, you're probably best to stay with the traditional active-passive and split the workload across the two of them, at least at this stage.
That just using DFS around the place and no clusters.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So the SMB3 in and of itself will be useful from there in terms of picking up the multi-channel. Again, what we're probably finding, though, is the benefits, again, on small files. We're not going to see huge benefits against SMB 3 from 2 across users opening small files across the network. Because a lot of the benefits, we're not going to go put Arnix into our desktops. Well, we might put them in our own, but probably not going to go and put them into users' desktops. And then the multi-channel, well, if you're only reading 1, 2, or 3 meg file, and by the time multi-channel works out what it's got to do, the file's arrived anyway. So then some of that stuff isn't going to make as much of a deal. Things like the check disk and and the continuously available shares will help to a certain extent. So, other questions? Yep. From what I understand, yes, they are. I've heard that the main ones are. And again, the question is going to be exactly which features of SMB3 will they implement. So the NAS vendor, so this is the other question to always ask. Yes, the NAS vendor says they support SMB3. Which portions of SMB3 are you implementing? Are you implementing multi-channel? Do we have SMB Direct? Do we have the trend? And asking some of those questions of your vendors. Do you have Branch Cache 2 support, for example? So it's one thing for them to say, yes, we support SMB3. It's another to know exactly which features within that that they will support. But from what I understand, most of the vendors are working towards, that at least offer SMB as an option on the NAS, are working towards SMB3 as well. Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming along and listening to me talk about this. There are some more sessions, obviously, that will go into similar details, private cloud, and understanding the file systems that are being introduced with Server 2012. There's my Twitter and blog details if you want to get in touch with me at some other stage. I would ask, and this I'll make a personal plea to you as well, this has been my first Tech Ed to come and present to, so I would appreciate your feedback on the session, what you've enjoyed, what you haven't enjoyed, and so on from there. And of course, you get to go in, you go in the draw to win a Scop Touch mouse as well. Also, if you are on Twitter, a lot of people have been having a lot of fun in the helicopter rides. I'm sure at lunch you saw the helicopter coming and going. So tweet out. I've been asked specifically to plug this one. So tweet that you want to ride, and WinServer team are happy to hook people up with helicopter rides. Thank you very much.
Oh, sometimes I get a good feeling.